Yep, we're on.
I'm Steve Sanderford with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, FCIC. Today's date is September 14th. The time is about 2 p.m. Eastern. I'm accompanied by various members of the FCIC, and we're at the offices of the OCC for the interview of Greg Coleman.
Would you mind just actually identifying who is here? And
we're going to do that. Yes. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Coleman. Mr. Coleman, could I get your verbal assent on the record?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, well, everyone, we'll go around the table. Please state your full name and affiliation and spell your last name to be clear. I'm Steve Sanderford, S-A-N-D-E-R-F-O-R-D. I'm on loan from the Richmond Federal Reserve to the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
I'm Randall Dodd with the research section of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and Dodd spelled D-O-D-D.
I'm Stephen Mintz, M-I-N-T-Z. I'm a writer assigned to help write the final report.
Linda Bridgman, Assistant Director of Enforcement and Compliance for the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency.
I'm Greg Coleman. I work in the Financial Markets Group of the OCC. Coleman is C-O-L-E-M-A-N.
Nathan Tarran, T-A-R-A-N. I'm an attorney in Enforcement and Compliance at the OCC.
Great. One more. Okay, in the way of background, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was established by statute and signed into law by the President. It's a bipartisan group that consists of 10 commissioners. The FCIC is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with writing a report of findings to the President and Congress by December 15th. In addition, I believe a critical aspect of the commission work is meeting with experts who've been involved in the financial markets, such as yourself. And our goal here today is to gain a better understanding of how OCC examiners conducted their work in large institutions, particularly related to complex capital market transactions. So now all the formal stuff is out of the way. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve. That sort of sums it up pretty nicely. We're trying to understand the causes of the crisis better and the role our federal regulators, played in trying to prevent it and where that might have broken down. And a key area, it seems to us, is how you deal with the innovations that occurred in the financial sector, particularly through off-balance sheet entities, or off-balance sheet transactions. So we're particularly interested in how you dealt with credit as well as market risks arising from derivatives transactions, not only in the major dealer banks, but also in the other banks that were presumably using them just to hedge. Also, how they dealt with off-balance sheet or non-consolidated special-purpose vehicles used for securitization or for issuing asset-backed commercial paper. And so, and then as a policy, this may not be what you're most comfortable with, but I would appreciate your opinion on it. It just a little bit of how, that's changed, not just during the moment prior to the crisis, but also how it changed maybe even in the decade prior to the crisis. For example, it seems to me a critical moment might have come not only with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, but prior to that, going back to the Federal Reserve Board's policy change in 87, which enabled banks to engage in issuing commercial paper and asset-backed securities and getting more into capital market activities, and how that policy change at the board affected the OCC and its obligations. So I know that's a mouthful, so I thought if you're more comfortable, if you want to just first give us your just run with that for a while, and then maybe we can come back with a few more particulars.
Actually, that is a mouthful. Could you just take one at a time and ask him if he has an opinion?
If that's where you're more comfortable talking.
Okay. Yeah,
I didn't know some people have a view and they like to spend 5 minutes just sort of saying, this is how I see that. But if you want, let's just take, for example, the role of some of the national charter banks who served as dealers in the over-the-counter derivatives markets.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do to try to grasp the risks imposed to those firms and perhaps certain risks to the financial system as a whole as a result of that market-making activity?
Right.
I'm sorry, when you say you, are you talking about the agency or Mr. Coleman
in particular?
Yes, ma'am.
I think, could I ask a question about the agency of the individual?
If he knows. I mean, I'm not trying to make this into a deposition, but the... so you're asking him as... On a policy-wise, I mean,
I was thinking of him as someone representing the supervisory efforts of the OCC, and so maybe I'm sorry if I'm too colloquial. How does the supervisory, you know, section of the OCC begin to supervise the credit risk and market risk arising from the role of certain banks as dealers in the over-the-counter derivatives markets, and was there an eye toward its potential impact, not just on that bank's solvency, but to broader financial system stability.
Mm-hmm. Can I give you some of my background?
Sure.
as what I've worked on? And that may help you understand kind of where I'm coming from when answering the questions. I started working on securitization activities in 98 and worked in that role at the OCC in our policy unit here in D.C., until the third quarter of 2005, approximately. So I was very active in working on policy issues related to how banks securitize, how that should be risk managed, capital-related issues for securitization, and then working on that with folks from other agencies. So that was really kind of my expertise. In the third quarter of 2005, probably September, I moved to our large bank supervision in New York, where I was head of capital markets for our team at JP Morgan Chase. So I think my perspective as I think about supervision was really focused on what I saw at that institution. I had limited knowledge of what would have occurred or how we supervised activities at the other large dealer firms.
Well, that was the largest dealer, so that's not a bad example.
Right. I say that, though, because I look at what I saw, what I was responsible for in the risk of managing not just credit, but all the risks that go along with the bank dealer activities.
At that bank.
At J.P. Morgan Chase. And they had what I felt to be a pretty strong culture of risk management at that institution. I think they had what to me seemed to separate them was strong MIS, meaning management information systems. The word culture, which, you know, I think came from the top of the house in that firm, that everybody in that firm, regardless of whether you were a risk manager or not, was responsible for risk. That's not to say we didn't have concerns about some of the things they did or how they could improve systems. But it was also the kind of firm where if you raised an issue, it was the only firm, to my knowledge, when we issued a supervisory letter that would have any matters requiring attention, or for that matter, any supervisory letter for the work we did related to banks trading activities, it was copied to the CEO, Jamie Dimon. Mm-hmm. And while I never had direct contact with Mr. Dimon, I do know our EIC at the time, when we would raise issues about their trading activities and we had noted concerns, would get a phone call. I know they were very wanted to know what we thought, so I think they were proactive in addressing our concerns. That doesn't mean they always agreed with us, but I think that was kind of the tone that was set. They took it to heart when we found issues that were wrong. I think we also had, I think, the way we supervised risk at that institution. I was in charge of kind of the capital markets team, so we covered price risk, liquidity, interest rate risk, and that's kind of how the OCC breaks down the risk classifications. My counterpart, who was responsible for credit risk, he also looked at how the bank would manage their counterparty credit risk associated with derivatives. So that was his primary responsibility, but we certainly helped, my team certainly helped on that at JP Morgan Chase because of the overlap in trading activities and management of counterparty credit risk. So we spent a lot of time looking at that and how they managed it. I think if there's one thing I look back on, is our team was very much focused on what J.P. Morgan Chase did. I don't think we spent a lot of time sharing best practices across other firms and what they did. I had a sense that they didn't have the same type of culture or risk management that the firm I was assigned to, but that would just be my opinion. That wouldn't be anything I could really base upon fact. I look back and I think that seems to be obvious in how some of these firms may have come out during the crisis and how well they managed through it. But if there's one thing, I think that when we have all of this knowledge in our supervisory teams at these large banks on how they manage this risk, if you can take that knowledge and kind of think about how you can manage that or take it horizontally and see where the best practices are across these firms. And I think the trick is then how do you get those firms to kind of implement those practices.
Greg, can I ask, the OCC is very good at coordinating information in a lot of credit risk areas, in my experience over the years. Do you think capital markets and trading activities are unique in terms of the type of examiner? I mean, what does, say, versus credit risk examiners, how many capital markets experts are there in comparison?
You mean at the agency or at the J.P. Morgan Chase?
No, at the agency.
Yeah. And what period of time are you talking about?
Let's say 2000, developing 2000 up to 2005. So you'd be coming in at 2005. Mm-hmm. So it's probably not fair just at 2005.
You know, I couldn't tell you how many people in the agency have a capital markets designation as their expertise, but I do think you can almost break down capital markets expertise into two areas. And one would be balance sheet management, and that's how the bank would kind of manage their treasury functions, their interest rate risk. And I use the term balance sheet, but it certainly could include off-balance sheet as well.
Securitization.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then you have kind of the trading activities. And I think that is a kind of a different skill set, because when you look at trading activities, I see every risk that you need to consider, from price, interest rate, operational, legal, credit. Those are all things you have to look at. Now, in the large banks that have the most significant trading activity, and we would supervise there's roughly five of them. When I first moved to New York, I'm trying to think how many people I had on my team, approximately six, and I think we grew the team to eight. There was significantly more credit risk people, maybe 20 to 25 people on the credit risk team.
This is just at J.P. Morgan?
Just at J.P. Morgan. And there's probably approximately the same number of examiners assigned to the other large banks, such as Bank of America, Citi, those two being the two other large banks with significant trading activity.
So I'm sorry, six to eight on which?
On capital markets activities, yes.
And then the 25 were on?
20 to 25, I think, on credit risk, yeah. If you want to, I mean, I'm sure our large bank people can provide the exact numbers. But I think my point is, you're dealing with trading activities are, I think, one of the most difficult things we supervise. One, you have to understand all risks. And I think there, because we have, every bank we have has some form of credit risk, but very few of our institutions are involved in trading activities. So there's just less chance to develop that expertise. I think we were successful at attracting, while I was there, some external people that we hired, that were not brought up internally in the OCC, but had expertise in actually served as traders or worked at the SEC or worked as auditors at, or maybe had work at a hedge fund. So they had that kind of inside knowledge of how things work in trading activities.
Right.
But that's definitely a challenge to attract those people that have those type of skills. I think even the firms would say that's a challenge to attract those type of people that have skills for an internal audit of trading activities. It can really, when you have someone who's in charge of market risk or head of the desk of their credit derivatives, that is telling you how that what type of strategy they're doing or what type of risk they have, that can look at the MIS they have and say whether that's it, and ask the right questions. So that's definitely a challenge. Mm-hmm. I think we definitely try to improve those skills, but I think it's something we continue to work on as an agency.
While we're talking about human resources here for a minute, how many people did the New York Fed have assigned to J.P. Morgan at the time?
On their core staff there, in total, they only had probably two or three capital markets people. But they also had resources at the New York Fed that could help out on specific issues. So just the core people assigned was a small
amount. And on the banking or credit side, how many?
Well, I'll say five, approximately.
And they
kind of took a different view. They had some person who was in charge of market risk, so they would cover both credit and price risk, where we broke up the two.
Yeah, kind of a bank book versus a trading book approach.
That's correct.
How did that relate to the fact that the New York Fed regulated the bank holding company, not the bank?
In any of these institutions, it's been my experience, and I don't speak as J.P. Morgan because that's the one I'm familiar with. There are numerous legal entities that are under the holding company, including the bank. And in almost every trading activity or exam, we would work closely with the New York Fed because some activities would be conducted outside the bank charter. Others would be conducted in the bank charter. So in order to make sure we had sharing of information, legal authority on any exams, and not only the New York Fed, but when we did our supervisory activity in the London branch, mm-hmm. we would often coordinate with the UK FSA as well. Additionally, the FDIC had a person on site who was always involved in any type of activity we were doing, maybe not directly, but always saw what types of exams we would be doing. You would always see the conclusion memos that we prepared, the supervisory letters we prepared, so they would be aware of any type of work we did related to supervision of trading activities.
So there would be one person at J.P. Morgan from FDIC?
At that time, there was one person from the FDIC, mm-hmm. yes.
There's been a lot written on this, and the issues with functional regulation, one of the sort of unregulated pieces, the OTC derivatives. Can you talk about how the Fed, the OCC, SEC kind of brought those derivatives into the total risk picture?
Right. At J.P. Morgan Chase, maybe this was to my advantage, having gone there, because they had converted their charter to a national bank charter. So for years, the Fed had been the primary supervisor there, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. We did not work at all with the SEC at any time while I was there. But because the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, their staff had such a strong core knowledge of the institution, they were very helpful for us, and it was really, I had to work closely with them on any type of supervisory activity related to OTC derivatives. That was also the time in 2005 when the OTC derivative infrastructure project started, which was led by the New York Fed, which focused originally on credit derivatives. It's expanded across all products now. But at that time, we were focused on reducing the number of outstanding confirmations for credit derivatives. I was, again, focused on what was going on at J.P. Morgan, but that type of activity was primarily in the bank charter, but it was something where you would work closely with the New York Fed. So I can't think of any examination or supervisory activity or even meetings that we conducted, because not only did we conduct targeted examinations, we would conduct what people would refer to as ongoing supervisory activities, where you're meeting monthly or quarterly with individuals from the different desks or the different risk control functions. and you would always coordinate those meetings with the Federal Reserve Bank. So somebody from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York would be in those meetings as well. So it was, and if they weren't, typically minutes were shared. Because at least on my team when I was there, we always would prepare minutes from these meetings.
When did they go to the, was it when they merged with Chase they went to a national bank from
That's
the
state? Correct. That's correct.
So they just brought in Chase's charter.
That's right.
They kind of operated with Chase's charter.
That's right. I think
and that was 2000?
2004, I believe.
2004. One thing that always was curious about is that you take a bank like J.P. Morgan has got at some point $93 trillion of outstanding notional on their OTC derivatives book.
Right.
Large amount of money. Does involve probably anywhere from 1 to 2 million different transactions, probably closer to two, I'm guessing. So there's some... both internal operational tasks of trying to make sure, indeed, not only they're confirmed, but even after they're confirmed, that you're keeping track, pricing them daily, facing off against your counterparty. You've got to be able to price not only the position, but any collateral posted against the position. You know, and then presumably, too, somehow in all that, you're managing the different, if you will, delta and gamma of those positions against your balance sheet books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of moving parts of this.
Absolutely.
And particularly when it's not perfectly standardized. So there's, you know, some of them are fairly inert, but not perfectly. And the times at which they're not inert, then they may be the most critical, although infrequent, times. So how do you, as a bank regulator, do you have any ability to independently calculate those figures or risks yourself, or are you primarily trying to closely monitor how the process with which they are monitoring and assessing these risks?
Right. Our focus at J.P. Morgan Chase was on the process, but we would also rely, and how we would do that, I'll explain the process that we would go through, is the MIS that J.P. Morgan produced, monthly or quarterly meetings with the controllers for the different books, and then the overall investment bank controller, a quarterly meeting with the CFO, and also the CFO of the different regions. At that time, there was a CFO for EMEA, Asia, and the U.S., so we'd have quarterly meetings with those individuals. Quarterly meetings with the folks who are in charge of market risk. So you're taking these different pieces of information from these different meetings along with the MIS to understand the process and where they have issues. Also, monthly or quarterly meetings with the audit staff. So you're getting a sense of where they're raising issues as well. And then also meetings with folks in the compliance function who may be raising issues related to certain trading activity. So it's really looking at the process, but having that ongoing dialogue with the institution. And I felt like we had an advantage at an institution like J.P. Morgan, where there was a culture from the top of the house that, you know, I never saw this written anywhere, but it was always understood that if we conducted an examination and found a repeat issue, a matter requiring attention, that was, those are the kind of things where people could lose their job because it would raise to the top of the house in that institution. And I think that just spoke of the culture in that institution. They expected issues to be corrected, and people that didn't correct issues didn't last very long. So that would give you some comfort in the process that they took those things seriously.
So if they had the right analytical framework for assessing risk, your system would pick up whether they were efficiently and thoroughly executing that activity.
That's right. And we did, with the hiring of some people who had both served as traders, served as auditors in these firms, they were also very good at going through their reports and picking up where maybe this risk measure doesn't look correct, or they told us this, but I'm seeing this in the MIS. So you had that, you know, leveraging that expertise of these individuals for us in trying to find out where, you know, what the issue was. So that was always, that was very helpful for us, having that type of expertise. But I would, you know, you started off by talking about the volume of transactions, and I think that's what a lot of people, even some examiners who haven't spent time in this area, don't realize, that in trading, operational risk is probably the biggest issue. And the firms, I think, that are, this is my opinion, the firms that probably do the best in trading activities globally are the firms that have the best systems, the best operating systems, and they've probably spent the money on technology. And again, I think that was something that was a big focus at JP Morgan Chase. And I think the firms that didn't spend money on technology probably suffered more. Because I think about, if you can't measure or manage your risk or monitor it, you know, I don't, it seems impossible. These firms are difficult enough when you know what's going on. I don't know how you do it when you don't know what's going on.
Particularly if you're global as well, it strikes me as one of the challenges would be to make sure that, you know, you've got your organization, as I understand it, broken down into desks. So you've got a fixed income desk, an equity desk, a credit desk, a commodities desk, mm-hmm. and you're trading cash and derivative products, and you've got that replicated probably in other countries. So you've got those thematic breakdowns in your desks that are managed probably on a day-to-day or minute-to-minute basis, a little bit like silos, right? And then at some point that's got to report up so that you're
that's correct.
Consolidated. Exposure is treated as a consolidated portfolio.
Yeah, JP.
But I don't know how frequently can they do that, and how can you be comfortable that their branch in South Korea and in Santiago are effectively assessing their risk and reporting it back for this consolidated assessment,
right? Right.
That you're, if you're sort of back in a Harry Markowitz world of diversification, if you've misassessed your components, then mm-hmm. your weights are wrong, and then your risk is higher than you thought, kind of thing. Right?
That's right. It was my experience at JP Morgan Chase is they had the ability on a daily basis to update those risk measures. Both from, in order to update those risk measures, you have to know what your positions are daily. We would always see a daily revenue report that the bank would send us that was distributed within, you know, internally, so they could see where they were at in terms of by each desk. JP Morgan, they, at the time I was there, they were structured by global products. So, for example, you had a global head of equities, a global head of interest rates, a global head of credit. But then they did have desks here by region, you're correct. They might be a head of the region, but then they would report up to that global head. But they have the ability at JP Morgan to update that daily. I can think of one book, their credit hybrids business, which was run out of London. And I can remember, we noted this during exam, and it was noted by their internal audit as well, that there was a few instances where they were not able to update their positions on a daily basis. And I believe the bank took the steps of even stopping the trading activity until they could get the operational fix.
What was the glitch? Was it they didn't have prices, or they didn't have, there was a computer hardware snafu or something?
My recollection at the time, because these were complex positions, I think it was I don't think they had the computing capacity at the time, which they changed. And I think what it was is they could update what their positions were, but I don't think their systems could update their risk measurements. So it was an operational capacity issue, which they fixed.
I said they thought they had the fair value of it, but they couldn't tell you what the VAR or the delta or gamma was on the thing, and so they weren't sure.
Right. And this was a business that was very heavily reliant upon models. So at times what models would have predicted didn't actually occur. So that was part of the issue, too.
Was this in 2008?
This would have even been before that. There was an issue, and it's because people never thought of these things, but it had to do with the, I'm trying to think of what company it was, but at the same time a company was being, their debt was being downgraded, somebody was also buying up their stock.
That would be General Motors.
That's what it was.
When
that's
they were
right.
downgraded in 2000, May 2005.
Five, that's right. So what was happening is you would expect the value of their debt to be decreasing, but because someone was buying up their equity, their debt was actually going up in value as well. So their models, you know, were on what you're, on how you would think.
Well, the convertible securities
right.
certainly were getting twisted,
right.
and then the it was messing up also their correlation models in the credit derivative space.
Exactly, and that's exactly what was happening. Yeah. So, but those were lessons that where they would go back. I found they were very thoughtful. Where they had people would go back and look as to why did things work the way they were, and how do we need to change this, and how can we better hedge our risk in these positions? Mm-hmm. So, again, looking at the process, I felt like they wanted to understand what went wrong, but also fix their systems. So that would that gave me confidence in the systems that they had.
A lot of what these banks do, it seems to me, relies upon how well the markets work kind of on a sunny day, on a normal trading day. We can trade, you know, we can dynamically hedge, you know, we can, it moves against us, we can short this, or we can sell some of our long, and we can, you know, change our position if the market changes. We have our own metrics of implied volatility and expected change, and so we can adjust with changes in the marketplace, and then at certain critical times, that ability to do that breaks down. And so what kind of preparations did they have in place to deal with when liquidity was interrupted, a trading market trading liquidity was interrupted, or you couldn't get market prices, or your models seemed to, you know, really have substantial, your models failed you. Mm-hmm. Then what kind of, how are they, you know, did they have a plan B?
Yeah, they had different plans for when liquidity would dry up in the market. They had, one was a firm that had very strong and enforced risk limits. So I think, you know, they had learned their lessons on some issues related to concentrations. So they would do various concentration limits, various risk limits, but also in coordination with the bank's treasury function. You know, they had thought about, okay, what if these markets shut down? How are we going to fund this activity? So those things were pretty well thought out at that institution. I think they would tell you is they were very focused on what if we could not access the market, what would we do for liquidity? How would we manage through it? They were not thinking about everybody being shut out of the market at once. That, I believe, the risk managers there would tell you would be their, I guess, failure to consider alternative funding issues. But I think at that point they might scratch their head and say, well, what else is there besides if the market reaches that point, really do you have any other option than central banks to step in to meet that funding? I don't know. I think, what else do you do at that point?
Yeah, I think it's kind of trying to plan for a post-nuclear Holocaust world. It's sort of, what's the point?
That's right. You can manage your liquidity up to a point. I think they did a very good job of trying to manage their counterparty exposures. You know, they had the ability to tell you who their largest counterparties were, who owed who what. They could do that on a daily basis. So, and again, I think that was another benefit of the fact that this is a firm where MIS was important, operational capacity was important.
Did you ever look at their use of Trioptima, or what they call it, Trioptima's platform, where they you put all your derivatives positions in it and use it to face off against all your counterparties? It's not tri-resolve. It's
I know what you're referring to. We did not look at that specifically, but I know, but we would monitor the outcome of that. Where it was they were reducing the number of outstanding trades and who they could pair off their trades against in a pool.
Well, that was the compression.
Right.
But then there was also just a protocol they could use just for daily mark to market, so that they could systematically say, because the market is so concentrated in the interdealer space, mm-hmm. since there's five big U.S. banks
right.
and maybe another five or six non-U.S. banks, so some huge portion of your 2 million OTC derivative contracts and some huge portion of that $93 trillion at J.P. Morgan would be with just nine other firms, right?
That's probably
60-70% of it. So you just even spread that evenly over 10 other firms, you need Dennis. What would that give you? Yeah, maybe 7 trillion firms. So that's a bunch of stuff going on right there. So I'd heard about the use of that Trioptima software, but I had never heard anyone that wasn't selling it to me try to tell me if they thought it worked well or not. So
right.
it just wasn't something you had bumped into.
When I was there, we did not specifically look at that.
Did you ever talk to them about, you know, there's a tendency in financial economics, I think, to always treat yourself as a price taker. I'm the marginal person in the market. I'm the marginal buyer. I'm the marginal seller. I can buy or sell. I won't move the price. And so similarly, if I'm managing my risk, you know, I can always go in and sell. I can always go in and buy, right? And it's a sort of a partial equilibrium analysis, right? It's so, like, in other words, they thought about how they could, if they had trouble raising liquidity in commercial paper, they had a plan for repo. If they had trouble in repo, they had a plan for using the treasury or unsecured interbank lending. They had maybe even other contingencies, but always presumed that there was still a commercial paper market, a repo market, interbank lending market. I mean, it still assumes that they're the ones in trouble, not that the world is in trouble.
That's correct.
And that they're trying to, that didn't seem to be part of their conceptual exercise to anticipate risks.
I don't ever recall them looking at the entire market melting down like that. As a matter of fact, afterwards, I can remember one of their individuals saying he was very experienced, been working in treasury functions. I'd worked as a trader and then worked in managing treasury functions for probably 20 plus years. And so these were people who had a lot of experience in some very sophisticated institutions. And I remember him saying to me, I never thought I'd see the day where I couldn't repo MBS. He goes, you could have never, an agency MBS.
Yeah.
He thought that would, but that's where I think people really started to understand what it means for counterparty credit risk. You know, people thought about it before.
FIC, right? They could have cleared that as a repo dealer. They'd have gone through the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation on an agency MBS. There wouldn't have been too much counterparty risk if they could have found, you know, sort of someone to trade in that marketplace, I guess, right? And that should have been. You don't have to worry about, you know, Bonnie or some other entity bailing out on you, because Fixed Income Clearing Corporation is pretty, was, I think, never had a, it was never perceived as being weak.
Yeah, I don't recall that ever coming up, but you know, the fact that nobody really wanted to trade with each other for a while.
Yeah. That was,
you know, it
yeah.
just.
Can I ask a quick question about just analysis that your team or through JPMC, you know, it sounds like there wasn't a lot of work with other teams, OCC. Was there any analysis around some of the spreads that started blowing out, you know, particularly in some of the markets about what might be causing that, or you know.
Are you talking the credit spreads of these different firms?
Yeah.
I know here in policy, I moved back here in March of 2008, right after Bear Stearns purchase. So I was, you know, had kind of still knowing what was going on at J.P. Morgan, but getting more involved in what was going on here in policy. So we probably spent more time here in policy kind of looking at what those credit spreads were,
yep,
and what was driving them, and trying to understand why some spreads were grinding wider than others. I mean, that's something we to this day, we pay a lot of attention to.
Yes.
I want to just correct something, and I'm not an expert on this because I'm on the lawyer's side, not on the supervision side. But in other interviews of our folks, there was discussion of the fact that large bank supervision does have what's called working groups.
That's right.
And they identify issues that come up. So I wouldn't say that they're, I mean, Greg may not be aware of the sharing of information, but I wouldn't conclude that there is no sharing of information among the teams.
Right.
Because there were about 6 or 7 or 8 working groups among the large banks, supervisors, the EACs, and they would have meetings and discussions, you know, on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis, where they would identify issues. Now, I don't recall specifically if there was a working group that focused on the issue of derivatives.
Right.
But we have identified those working groups and produced materials from those working groups.
Yeah, there was a capital markets working group. And we would participate on those. Maybe we'd meet quarterly. But those were, I think what I'm trying to differentiate is between doing a horizontal exam where you're looking at five institutions and doing a full scope exam versus having a meeting and discussing what may be potential issues. Now, one thing we've done, or we started to do since I moved back in 2008, we also hold a monthly price risk call. That's what we refer to it as. We collect data from our large banks each month on their revenue and risk measures.
Okay.
And we hold, and we put together a report, 2 or 3 pages, and we look at, and then we hold a conference call, and the different institutions talk about their performance, emerging risks, where they're making money, where they're losing money, what seems to be their concerns in the markets, and then so we produce this monthly report as well. And that's something that probably started after I moved back here in 2008. So,
and it seems that would help identify if everyone's doing the same thing, and that the system's building up a position that wouldn't look alarming at one firm, but would look
absolutely
very different if everyone were doing
it. So, I mean, Linda's correct. We do have these working groups, but it's different than horizontal examinations.
Yeah.
We're thinking about some of the stories that we've, you know, gotten, case studies of the banks. I mean, we have Fed and OCC bank reports. You know, kind of late in the game, a lot of the activity was stopped, and it sounds like JPMC didn't, you know, their risk systems were better. Were there turning points that you saw, say, when the JPMC decided to drop out of CDO? And I don't have a complete picture of there. I know with Wachovia, there was a point where they, you know, were large CDO originated and then backed out. There were signals in the market, discussions with regulators. What were there any of those points of JPMC market-driven, where either they came and you were aware of, or the regulators?
Yeah, we. When the spread started to widen, concerns started to grow about issues like CDOs or off-balance sheet activities. You know, I was at J.P. Morgan Chase, and I was going through all the MIS, and I realized there's really not that much here. So it never really was a focus for us. They had very little exposure to that. No SIB exposure. They had one SIV that they had sold prior to the crisis to Standard Charter, I believe. And I remember a conversation we had with one of their, it's actually the head of, this. To me, I think this speaks volumes of how they think about risk there. There's a conversation we had in London with the head of sales and marketing. So this is a sales and marketing person who's, you know, you would not, in my experience in firms, they're not typically people who think about risk. They're thinking more about how we can make deals
happen. How we can get more risk. Yeah.
That's right. And his view was when we started talking about these exposures, they looked at, okay, what are we getting compensated for and what risk are we taking? And they realized they didn't feel they were getting compensated appropriately for the risk they could be taking on in some of these exposures. And that's why they got out of it. So, and I think that's, you know, good for them. You know, they still had some exposures out there, but certainly not like other firms. And I know my recollection, they had some exposures even of CDOs in one of their asset-backed commercial paper conduits, which, from what I learned when that made its way to the top of the house, I think somebody lost their job because the firm felt like that's not what these were set up for. So we shouldn't be taking that type of risk in that type of structure because we're not getting compensated for it.
So, Greg, that was an example where the MIS hadn't been brought forth to that point in this ABCD conduit.
Well, it was there. That was the thing.
It
was
been identified.
Yeah, every month you could see the report and see, but it was a small exposure as well. It was probably less than 5% of the total outstanding of the commercial paper, so it wasn't a big amount either. But it was something you could see. But you know, I think.
But that measured the exposure in a narrow sense of either they had some subordinate debt or were holding commercial paper themselves, or because I mean, it turned out the risk of those wasn't an equity or.
Well, this was in the conduit, so it was actually it was where the conduit owned the actual CDO. It wasn't where it was an off-balance sheet, right. They were providing a liquidity facility. This is where the conduit had actually gone out and purchased this CDO, mm-hmm. this essentially bond, and issued commercial paper to fund it. So that was, but again, it was not.
But then the J.P. Morgan's exposure to that was.
Was the conduit off balance sheet at that time?
Yeah, the conduit was off balance sheet. That's correct.
Liquidity backstops or credit.
Yeah,
backstops?
I believe they ended up purchasing that CDO out and taking the, and writing it off.
So they just brought the SIB back into the balance sheet, essentially.
Yeah, well, the CD, not the SIB, but the CDO. Yeah, it was a CDO issue. I don't know who was the issuer, but yeah, they brought that back on balance sheet and wrote it off. My recollection.
From a capital standpoint, is this. You know, a lot of the conduits came back on balance sheet because of support.
Right.
Was that at the time of support? Did that cause the ABCP conduit to be brought back on?
I don't believe it did at that time. But then I was also in the middle of transitioning out of the supervision of that institution, so I don't recall. But. Yeah, typically, if you're providing that type of implicit support, that would be something we would want to take a look at to whether that should be brought back on balance sheet.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that does seem to be one where the capital regulatory regime kind of didn't seem to fare very well during the crisis, and that banks weren't taking a very substantial capital charge for their sponsorship of some of these off-balance sheet
liquidity puts.
Right, especially for, I think that's where you have to, in my opinion, you have to differentiate between if you have a true asset-backed commercial paper conduit that's consumer-oriented, or excuse me, customer-oriented.
Right.
Where they really, the business got its start, where they're really serving as a means for corporations to fund their trade receivables.
Yep.
And my experience, they've done a pretty good job at underwriting those trade receivables, and their losses were very small. So I think you can look at those when they have the right underwriting and their business is focused on funding these corporate trade receivables. You could probably argue that the capital for those liquidity facilities makes sense, but when you're start talking about liquidity facilities that are supporting a SIB that has CDOs as the underlying assets, and the CDOs, their underlying assets, are subprime mortgages, then I think you have to question what is the right amount of capital when you have subprime mortgages and you have concerns about the underwriting. And, you know, I think I sound like a broken record, but when I think about, you know, where did things go wrong for this whole financial crisis, I go back to underwriting. You have bad underwriting.
But they knew it was bad underwriting in the sense that they knew these were subprime loans. There's no pretense that these were prime loans, so we know it was a risky loan. And maybe they were crummier than we thought. But
but they also didn't think home prices could ever go down either.
Well, or they just basically had the wrong model for pricing these instruments, and what they thought was AAA wasn't, and what they thought was A wasn't, and what they thought was triple B wasn't. But then again, I guess the point might be then slightly altered that with the consumer debt oriented ABS. Commercial paper vehicles, those are kind of known entities. That was kind of an established product, been trading for a long time. So they had a track record, whereas this was a fairly new product. And so you're more apt to get surprised.
That's correct.
So I don't know how you assign capital requirements based on the life of the asset class, right? Because that's not the way quants think.
That's right, and you've got deterioration underwriting standards, and you've got, and you're right, but pricing of those assets as if underwriting standards were the same as prime mortgages that were originated in 2002, and I think that's not going to play well for people.
So what's the thinking then on how to assign capital requirements going forward then on when we've got these off-balance sheet variable interest entities and other special purpose vehicles, and our exposure to them is not just due to the liquidity put, but also the reputational risk that might have you end up buying the whole thing back. That being both of those being a hard calculation to make, right? Particularly reputational risk is hard to model, and even the credit risk on the liquidity put is hard to model if it's a new asset class or involves some new structure. So how do you begin to... that's one area where it seems to me the capital charges were woefully inadequate.
Well, what has happened now is, and that's also with changes in accounting, those conduits are all on balance sheet now. So banks are holding capital as if they were their own assets. I think that, in my opinion, though, I think that you also have to weigh if we want corporations to have access to the funding markets, the capital markets, and one of those vehicles is commercial paper. Do we need to find a way that where you can have these true customer-driven conduits, where the capital is not as onerous as if bringing everything on balance sheet? I don't know. I think that's something we need to consider, though, if we want, you know, if we want to have corporations that can have access to funding trade receivables through commercial paper conduits, and make that, you know, what is the right capital charge? Maybe we didn't have it right before, but it also seems to me for the true third-party consumer or customer receivables, I don't know if the full 100% capital charge of bringing it back on balance sheet makes sense either.
Greg, would you? Some discussion has been that maybe single seller conduit structures, I've heard both sides of that. Do you have an opinion? You know, in that exact situation, could a single seller structure versus a multi-seller structure?
My view, I think, would be you're probably better off with a multi-seller than a single seller because you've also...
Banks like that view.
Yeah, I think you look at their performance of their true third-party receivables there, they've been pretty good. I also think when you have a single seller, then again, you've got this concentration. It really goes back to One, my experience, those have been a lot of the captive auto companies have done the single seller conduits because they're trying to find a way to fund their auto loans in there and using the commercial paper market for that. Until they, almost like a warehouse facility, until they can build up enough volume to issue a securitization. You know, I think ultimately you know as you're looking to the strength of that captive auto dealer, as opposed to some of these firms that have the multi-seller, if they have the right credit underwriting in place, taking the right haircuts, and again, true third-party receivables. I think that's a little different.
It doesn't raise the same reputational risk as these other structures did for the banks that manage them.
Either that or it totally raises the reputational risk because they've underwritten everything versus purchasing with a rate. So.
Well, it seems like if I'm a bank and I've got a bunch of clients and they want to manage their receivables and I put together a commercial paper program for them and it's got five different, you know, non-financial corporate names in it as the ultimate beneficiaries of the CP, then it doesn't raise as much reputational risk as if I put some CDOs that I bought into it.
Right.
And then am the sole kind of vendor to this drone corporation, then it seems like it's really my zombie. Mm-hmm. And if it blows up, then it's only,
right.
I put it together, my assets, my swap, my fees, you know, you happen to be holding the commercial paper, and so then it's my reputational risk, whereas if it's all these other guys' commercial risk in that vehicle, then it seems a little bit less my fault that blew up.
That's how I would view it, because you've also, the people who are managing the conduit for the bank, they want to make sure, their compensation performance is going to be based upon how well that conduit performs. So they want to make sure they do their underwriting, as opposed to a conduit or a sieve or some other off-balance sheet facility that's set up simply so you can generate product on balance sheet and move it off.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some different financial incentives there for people.
I don't know how you could find that. When you were a supervisor, you had access to all this? I mean, you could see what J.P. Morgan... You said they only had one, but I guess were your colleagues at Citi watching this stuff kind of...
When you say one...
You said they had one SIV at J.P. Morgan?
Oh, they had one SIV, but they sold it prior to... I don't know when, but they sold it prior to anything in the market melting down.
So it wasn't part of your experience when we're earlier.
It wasn't. So it really, I don't know what the other folks were doing who were my counterparts at Citi or Wachovia or Bank of America. I knew I had MIS that showed me what those exposures were. Matter of fact, I remember us when we started getting questions as to what were the SIV exposures, and I thought, I must be crazy here because we don't, everyone else is saying we've got X amount and we didn't have any. So my first thought was, okay, something's wrong with the MIS here. They have to have something. But
okay.
They didn't have any. It was just that plain and simple.
Greg, who was asking them? Was it the policy group here?
There were questions coming out. It was questions coming out of the policy group. Yeah. But at the time there might have been questions coming at the same time out of the New York Fed as well of their staff. So that would have been one of those issues where we were both probably looking into the issue.
From what point in time?
Oh boy, I'm gonna say late 2007, early 2008.
Yeah, that would be the time.
So sometime it would have had to have been because I read this conversation. It would have, probably 2007 because. I remember having this conversation in London with their head of sales and marketing about, how did you end up without any exposure to SIVs? So,
can I ask some capital type questions? And I know we've got a meeting with Kevin, potentially Omri on Friday, and you've been in the middle of some of this. Capital arbitrage is a popular topic.
Mm-hmm.
ABCP conduit programs, we kind of know. I like your comments here. What about other capital arbitrage in terms of your opinion about contribution to the crisis, and considering your history in the policy group, things like the market risk amendment and the use of a BAR framework?
Right.
I mean, do you have an opinion on our capital rules and how they may have contributed to the crisis as well?
I didn't really see that as contributing to the crisis, at least at J.P. Morgan. We spent a significant amount of time at that institution looking at their internal models for measuring that market risk and complying with the market risk rule. I chuckle just because that was very complicated work, and you know, meetings that were, you know, where you're dealing with quants from the institution and risk managers from the institution, and our quants, where there was a quant from the OCC assigned pretty much full time looking at their models, and just that, you know, healthy debate back and forth between the bank and the regulators as to what our expectations were for what those models should look like. And we were pretty insistent, and I think that's pretty well documented, at least at J.P. Morgan Chase, as to what our expectations were around those models, both in terms of backtesting the models, documentation of the actual model itself, changes to the model, annual validation of the model that it still works, anything like that. So we spent, there was one person on my team who I would say that took up a significant amount of his time, and then along with the quant, and then you know, myself attending these meetings. So we spent a lot of time looking at their, how they complied with the market risk rule and making sure those models were correct for the different books within JP Morgan.
And by correct, you're meaning that you've got a certain VAR, and on the basis of that, you're assigned a certain market risk that you're taking a certain amount of capital charge.
Exactly. That's right. That's right.
If you made an error looking back, if in backtesting models, there was revealed an error, what consequences would there be for the firm?
Well, there's within the market risk rule, if there would be times where their model had predicted that they should only lose a certain amount and they lost more, then there's essentially a matrix within the market risk rule where it requires them to hold additional amounts of capital for essentially a penalty for inaccuracies in the measurement of their risk. This was probably one area where I think we had assistance from our risk analysis division, people would call it RAD, mm-hmm. and those people would come out and help us look at them. They were quants themselves, so they would look at the model and how it worked. They were spending time looking at that model across firms, so they knew the weaknesses or the strengths in the models used by other firms, and that was probably one area where I felt we did a pretty good job on, because we did have that kind of horizontal knowledge across firms that really paid off for us. Because anytime you go in these institutions, and a lot of these people may have worked at other firms themselves, or they know their counterparts at other mm-hmm. firms, and they will say, well, we understand you're not requiring that of this firm. That argument never seemed to go very far with me, because I felt like it doesn't matter what we're doing at firm A, we're concerned about the risks of firm B. But we could say whether that was true or not, because we had people who were looking at those models across the firms. And so they were helping the individual exam teams. One thing also, those folks that worked in that risk analysis division were on, we rarely did an exam of trading activities that we did not have somebody from our risk analysis division along. Because almost any book you look at is relying upon models to measure their risk or manage their risk, so you need somebody there to meet with the folks who put those models together. So they were a big assistance to us.
Very key piece of, you talked about backtesting and the validation and the annual review, the matrix for validating the backtesting.
Right.
One key piece that's emphasized in the guidance that the agencies have is the stress testing component.
That's
because
right.
There's a historical sort of bar has a sort of
that's
historical
right.
bend. What was your opinion on JPMC and their stress testing in the bar.
And what period of time?
2000, when you were there, 2005 to when you left. Mm-hmm.
That was a firm where they were always trying to, I think, I had never, again, never had conversations directly with Mr. Diamond, but I had always understood he was not much of a believer in Barr. But I think he'd probably say, and I would feel that would agree, it's one measure, it's one tool you can use. I think the bank spent a lot of time coming up with different stress measures. They would run sometimes their regular stress scenarios, but they would often overlay maybe some macro stress scenarios, depending upon what they were concerned about. This was a bank that developed what they referred to as rifles or risk identification for large exposures. That's what the rifles stood for. So things that maybe couldn't be hedged or couldn't be modeled, they would come up with these large exposures to try to identify where they were at across the firm. So they were, I think, pretty good about thinking about what these risks were. This was also a firm that in probably 2007 put on a pretty large, what they referred to as their macro hedge, where they bought a large amount of S&P puts. Now, this wouldn't be in the bank charter because they wouldn't be allowed legally to do that, but you know, they're thinking about managing, you know, they don't manage their risk by the bank, they manage their risk by the firm. But they were concerned about potential issues in the market, and so they realized that if we have a deterioration in the market, this will help offset some of those losses, these S&P puts. So it was an expensive, somewhat of an expensive hedge, but I think it paid off for them. So again, that's you know, that all comes about their thinking about where their risk was, where their stress loss exposures could be, across the firm.
The rifles and the macro hedge, you know, kind of outside of the bar framework proper. Were the RAND folks, I mean, was that being done at other institutions? Maybe you were told.
I do not know. I don't know if they, I'm sure other firms had different ways of how they measured stress.
Yeah.
Or managed stress. I don't know. I don't know if they were. My sense is, because J.P. Morgan, I felt, had strong MIS, probably had the ability to do a better job of running stress scenarios because you have the information available.
That's right.
That's my opinion.
Who would do these? What part of the firm would construct these scenario analyses?
Typically, at J.P. Morgan, it would be their folks in market risk. They would have a market risk division, or it could be the folks in credit risk, or combination of the two. It could be within the different lines of business. It really depended upon what the issue was.
Are these the puts they bought from Buffett, by chance? Couldn't help.
I don't know. I do not know. I don't know.
He sold something like $38 billion of S&P puts to the market. I'm just curious.
I don't know.
I thought they were longer dated, but... Please.
You have made reference a number of times to, aside from the state of mind of top management as far as risk goes, to the quality of MIS and the expense of MIS. Mm-hmm. I wonder, is that to say smaller firms that can't afford MIS of that quality are not candidates for participating in this market? Where's the line?
I think it does make it challenging for smaller firms when you don't have those resources. But then again, you have lots of, now that I think about it, you've had a lot of consolidation in the hedge fund industry as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure even some of the larger firms, because they have the resources to put into the better MIS, probably the better risk management, they probably thrive as well. So I think when you have these global markets, and I think you want to attract the top people, that probably does help, I'm guessing. I don't know anything about Goldman Sachs and what I read in the newspaper or from analysts, but or talk to people who work there. But I do know there's this, certainly this perception that they have very strong MIS, very strong systems. And so my thinking is, if you're some top person in the field of trading or coming out of grad or an MBA, and you can go to the place that has the best systems and the best risk management, that's probably why they attract the better people, because they can manage that risk better. So, and I think people that are doing that are probably taking these jobs because they want to make a lot of money. And so there's that incentive there too.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is just not a level playing field.
Yeah, but then again, I think also these firms, over time, some of their competitors may have appeared more profitable, but their competitors were not putting money into their systems. So, I remember reading a story about some OTS institution in California who, I wish I could find the story, because I guess this guy was criticized for the fact they never got into a lot of he was very conservative in their mortgage lending, and his shareholders were, why are you losing market share? What's wrong? And I'm thinking, he looks like a genius now because he didn't get into this. But I think for the firms who want to spend the money or do the right things, it's probably the long-term benefit to the shareholders. So does that end up that some of the smaller firms who don't do that, or even the larger firms who don't do that, maybe have a competitive disadvantage? I guess so. But I think you could say that in just about any field, I think, from what I know about industry. I think that's just, I look at banking as a business like anything else, and the people who decide to spend money on I think, building out better infrastructure probably do better in the end.
Regulators do decide who's eligible to play in certain markets.
That's correct.
But there is less of that in this market. I mean, is that something the OCC would ever consider?
I don't know if he's qualified to answer that question.
I won't push it if that's the case.
Well, I think the only thing I would say is we do spend time approving what products if they would come to us with a product they wanted to trade, we would spend time reviewing that. And when we would review that product, we would look at their operational capacity, their ability to manage the risks, all of those things before we would give an approval for it.
Greg, can I ask specifically about the new product approval process? Did you think it was an effective process, or was it a policy that came off the shelf? And did they really use it?
Are you talking about OCC or the banks?
The bank's new product approval. Thank you.
We spent a lot of time looking at the new product approval process at J.P. Morgan. I thought it was an effective process there. Again, we would coordinate with the Fed on this because it often cut across legal entities. We would meet, think quarterly, at least quarterly, if not monthly, but most likely quarterly, with the group that kind of maintained the database of new products and where they were at, so we always knew what they were and whether we needed to provide any type of legal approval or review. So not only did we have a specific targeted exam of the process so we understood it, but we would look at the new products that were going through the approval process. We would see what they were on a monthly basis. We'd get that report. We'd meet with the people who kind of oversaw it. And then the folks on my team who were responsible for looking at, for example, the global rates business, would meet with the folks in that line of business to discuss what those issues were, and what types of risks were present in those products. So,
so there were actually products that were put into the list of new products.
Absolutely. And we would also, you know, follow up on new products that we approved to see that they were complying with the requirements we laid out for those products as well.
I'm sorry if I'm so horribly ignorant about this. This is like a Reg Y of what's considered a banking product. It's like a Fed Reg Y issue. This is a banking product, and you've got to designate it as a banking product, and you've got to also approve whether the various banks have the sufficient competence and systems to engage in these new products. Right?
I think there's the legal.
It's a product by product and institution by institution level.
There's the legal piece in with the SEC. Is it a permissible product?
Right.
I'm familiar with the Fed's Reg Y process, but then there's the what are our risk infrastructure around this product? Do we have MIS? Can we develop that? It's ineffective in some organizations. They never find a new product. So.
Correct. That's the two things. One, if it's legal, which then you'd still look at all the risk infrastructure, or maybe it's just legal. It's a product that they can trade, but it's something they haven't traded before, or maybe they're moving into a new region. That could be a change to it. So those types of things, they would look at it when they would join a central clearinghouse. They would consider that some type of new product or a new customer. So they would go through and identify what their risks were and how they should manage those risks. So they would get senior management sign off on all those types of things. So the different people from legal, compliance, accounting would all sign off on that.
Were there ever instances where either you put brakes on products, limits,
yes,
grow a little bit,
yes,
sorry, or just kind of raise the eyebrows? Yeah.
What kind of things got disapproved?
When at J.P. Morgan, when I started there in 2005, they had a focus on building out their commodities business, and we spent a significant amount of time reviewing their requests for trading different types of commodity-related products within the bank, but looking at how they were going to risk manage those products. And we found several weaknesses within that, and essentially in supervisory letters told the bank that until they corrected those deficiencies, they couldn't do that type of activity within the bank. And from my recollection, the individual who was in charge of commodities business at the time, because of the concerns that we had and the fact that senior management felt he didn't take our concerns serious enough, he was let go. So again, I think that speaks to the fact that the firm took those issues seriously that we would raise.
These concerns include suitability toward the client or any other investor protection rules, or is it primarily, does it conform to the bank statutes as a bank product, and then you look at it from a kind of firm-level stability and maybe a market-level stability issue?
Well, we'd already signed off that it was something legal they could do, but we were more concerned about their ability to manage that risk and the infrastructure they had to manage it, also the expertise within the institution. A lot of the issues were around both operational capacity, but their ability to measure and manage that risk because they were really trying to grow their energy trading business in those things such as coal and power in the different regions. It's a different market than your more, I guess, typical financial products.
It's not a treasury bill. No.
What's that?
It's not a treasury bill.
No. And I think, and so we were fortunate is one of the guys on my team was a energy trader, so we were fortunate to have that type of expertise on our side of the house. So,
and I wanted to go back to what Mr. Mintz said earlier. I may not have been fair because the OCC does approve or disapprove a bank charter when a bank or an institution wants to become a national bank. I think you may have been going in that direction.
I was leaping perhaps into a different question. But the uneven playing field is very interesting to me. I mean, I wonder if it evens it out.
So we've kind of we've talked about a lot of good things. Bar, we weren't there. So sort of some of the credit derivatives pieces. More along the lines of securitizations, we did talk about ABCP some. But, and again, in terms of your involvement, but securitizations in the RMBS, ABCP, other, and then the additional structuring activities, CDOs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What was your experience? And it sounds like it's limited to JPMC.
This is one place where I had experience at other institutions. I spent time prior to working at JP Morgan Chase when I was still here in DC. I assisted our supervisory team at Citi, but focused strictly on securitization. And that was really related to credit cards at Citi. So I guess this is more background information for you, but probably in 2000, the OCC, we made a decision that we needed to increase our number of examiners that had a knowledge of securitization activities. So we built up myself and another individual, kind of set up a little training program for securitization. We identified institutions, national banks, that had securitization activities. We identified, I think, 10 to 12 examiners in the field who had interest in this activity. And for a year, we took those individuals and went to firm after firm after firm and conducted securitization exams.
Is that like JCB's?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So I felt the way you're going to learn this is by going, is how I learned it, by going into firms and seeing how they do it, reading the deals, seeing how they manage risk, but at the same time we can conduct some supervisory activities. So we developed up, some people with some pretty decent securitization skills at that time. I was fortunate because a lot of the securitization activities when I first went to JP Morgan were managed out of Chicago. And one of those people, she's no longer with the OCC, but she was there at the time and had worked on the staff at Chase. So we had a very strong knowledge of how they manage securitization at JP Morgan Chase. So felt pretty good about how they manage the securitization side of it. I had a pretty strong knowledge of how they manage securitization and how they structure transactions at Citi, at least as it related to credit card transactions. I really was not that involved with the underwriting side of the house. That was more our retail credit. I certainly know what I found interesting, at least working at Citi, and in my opinion, the people who manage the securitization structures at Citi are probably some of the best in the business. But again, I found them to be people who thought about risk. I know they would raise concerns about the credit quality of some of the cards that were going into their structures, because I think they view their structures as kind of, these are ours. We have to sell this to investors, and it's going to be hard to face these investors if we're selling them stuff that's backed up by poor receivables. I can remember a comment from the head of securitization there that, you know, we spent years trying to get some of the poor credits out, and this was at the time when I think Citi went out and bought the Sears portfolio. That may have been 2003, 2004, and his point was, and once you know, swoop of the pen, we get all those accounts back. But I think credit card business is also about market share and things like that too, and expanding that customer base. So, but I felt in those two institutions, the folks who at least oversaw those retail securitization structures in both firms were pretty strong. And those structures, I think they recognized the risk of having poor underwriting, but tried to set up those structures to manage that risk.
And did you credit cards, they were definitely a focus of the early 2000, 2001, the residual rules.
Exactly.
Did the securitization group, Josie and all the other folks, Kelly Ballard, did that help or were they involved with mortgage securitizations? And if not, maybe philosophically, why?
That group was involved with mortgage securitizations. A lot in some firms that was done outside of the bank charter.
Yeah.
Especially as it related to the structure of CDOs.
Yeah.
I think people looked at what was going on just in the bank and didn't focus enough. Those CDOs may have been done outside the bank charter or that activity, but people never took the time to look at, did any of that risk translate back to the firm? Could the bank be exposed to that even though it's outside the bank charter? I think that was something I learned pretty quickly working at J.P. Morgan Chase, is you can't just think about what goes on in the bank charter. You have to think about what they're doing outside of that institution or outside of that legal entity, because it one way or another can come back to the firm.
As a supervisor, you have, I guess, the latitude to tell the regulated chartered bank that we think your behavior, conduct or activities of your affiliates are possibly threatening the reputation and the solvency of the regulated entity.
You know, from a legal matter, I don't know. I think we certainly could raise that issue. I don't know what enforcement. I mean, that's something we'd have to.
Well,
this legal as far as
in the reports of exams and the supervisory letters, if you decide or determine that a product or activity is creates a significant risk, you put that in the RLE.
Even if it's an affiliate.
Yeah, we certainly could raise that as an issue. Absolutely. Again, that would be something where we would work closely with the Fed as well to get their perspective of it.
Or if it's regulated by the SEC, talk with the SEC.
That's correct. I think when we would conduct either on exams or these ongoing supervision where you're just meeting these quarterly ongoing meetings, and we would meet with the heads of these market risk, they never would speak about just what's going on in the bank. They were talking about what was going on in the business. J.P. Morgan, we did an extensive review in London of their legal entity structure because we wanted to understand what went on, what was the purpose of the legal entities, what activity occurred in there. So we understood the risk, but also we knew where we should focus our efforts, where the Fed had primary supervisory responsibility, where we had primary supervisory responsibility, and what those risks were. So that was another key thing of understanding that firm, what were the major booking legal entities, and so we could focus our efforts for supervision.
Did, I was just asking, just along those lines, if any of their OTC derivative activities was done outside the banking charter?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It would be, what was the motivation there?
Primarily for legal reasons. They could, some of those activities they couldn't conduct inside the legal entity, such as certain commodities activities or equity activities.
Huh.
So the rates business and credit business was typically conducted within the bank charter, but typically equities and commodities typically conducted outside the bank charter.
Sorry, Steve.
No, I was just going to say there's often, it's not just you, I hear it all the time, the sort of blanket notion of risk, but if what you're saying is true, the risk is not really the same at all institutions. The risk might be different at J.P. Morgan or another institution that has less of a, you know, so how does one define the risk, you know, does that, is that aspect of risk considered? Am I asking a clear question? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm not certain of the following.
Well, the point we were discussing before is if it's not a level playing field, risk is not going to be different at different points, different organizations. Something that's risky will be less risky to J.P. Morgan because they have the apparatus in place to deal with it, but less risky somewhere else. So is one deciding, well, this is risky based on what a J.P. Morgan can do with this, or based on what somebody less equipped can mm-hmm. do?
Right. Okay.
And what's the question?
The question is, I'm getting the question. The question is that the notion of risk, is it looked at as a sort of what is your benchmark when you use to decide something's risky? What is the benchmark?
Okay, I believe I'm following your question here. First, if it's a new product or there's a legal permissibility question, an institution would send a letter into the OCC asking for permission to conduct that type of activity. That would be a legal matter, and then once that legal approval was given, that would apply to any institution. But the second step in that process would be for the on-site team to make a safety and soundness decision as to whether the bank had the risk management capacity to conduct that type of activity. So while there may be a legal approval given, that doesn't mean there's a safety and soundness approval given, or sometimes we would refer to it as an EIC or examiner in charge approval. So there would be consideration given to their ability to manage that risk. I think at times it was considered that, well, I don't know. I think once there was a legal approval given, it may have just been assumed that other firms could manage that risk as well.
Which is not the correct assumption.
I don't believe so. No. I think some firms have better risk management than others.
And that's, and I don't want to belabor this, but then if once you say okay to J.P. Morgan, you can't be selective about which banks can manage this kind of a product.
Well, I think he answered the question that the people on the ground at the bank have to assess the safety and soundness.
Can they do it bank by bank, though? Can they decide this?
Yes, we can.
Okay,
yes.
That's fine. That's
yes,
a good answer.
We have the example that you had about the energy training.
Obviously, we're
knowledgeable.
No, we did have that ability to say no, they could not do that. But I do think when you have one firm starting to do it, there becomes pressure for the other firms wanting to do that as well. Mm-hmm. So, it's difficult for me to say that all firms were held to that same standard. I know what my expectations were at J.P. Morgan. I don't know we have guidance, we have policy, but I don't know, you know, if you're not doing some type of horizontal exam, you can't say that it's all being applied the same.
Thanks.
And you weren't at a level to know.
That's right.
So I think we're going to go till 4, so we've got about 25
minutes. Can I ask another, and Greg would say I wasn't involved or whatever, but mm-hmm. I'm kind of into this capital arbitrage. So
okay.
Another securitization, quasi-synthetic transaction that was really innovative, and you may have been involved on the policy side, but it was a JPMC structure, the Bistro deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an over-the-counter structure. That's a structuring structure, even before we had the ratings-based approach. Do you think that the capital charges in the Bistro structure were appropriate? Kind of like we talked about with ABCP and liquidity facilities.
Yeah, because that transaction occurred in
97.
Yeah, right.
You would have, been on the policy side.
Yeah, I would have just gotten here.
So it's fair to say I was just kidding.
I don't know if looking back, it's probably easy to say. But that was also a time where the underwriting standards were a little bit different.
Yeah.
So I think at the time those might have made sense for that underwriting. But I don't know for some of the transactions that would have occurred in 2005 if you could say the same thing. If you would have been applying the same type of capital, considering underwriting had changed dramatically.
Yeah, we did, in different banks, have referenced asset portfolios and special capital.
Right. That's right.
Approved. Yeah, I guess the question is, in hindsight, was that appropriate?
For that transaction, probably was. To apply it to all transactions with various levels of underwriting, I can't see how it would be. Especially because those were commercial loans.
They were all commercial.
Yeah. So you're going to have, that's where you've got, who knows how this, the various structuring or underwriting within those. So it's going to be a very case-by-case basis.
That transaction was a little bit different in that their counterparty wrote a swap, a true counterparty.
That's right. That's right.
Later deals would evolve.
That's right.
Well, Greg, shifting back a little bit, to this question, how the challenge of supervising an entity's risk management when it's so vast and complex in some of these larger dealer firms. When you look at J.P. Morgan's role as a dealer, they're a dealer in a broad range of OTC derivative products. Did you have the authority to comment and assess, not just their own risk management to that firm, but how they were conducting themselves as dealers in the market? I mean, you backed out of this market when the volatility got high. That was, of course, profitable for you, but it left that market illiquid. Or you're too much of that market. You're 80% of the trading volume. The market depends too heavily on you. In other words, it seems like I'm asking how much authority you think the banking regulators have by dint of regulating the firms that are the principal dealers to look at how that market trading activity occurs, because it doesn't only affect that individual bank.
We would not get involved in their market making or how much liquidity they were providing to the marketplace. That was never a focus of our exam work. But we would spend time looking at their size of activity or concentration of positions in the market, because that was more of a safety and soundness concern, that having those large exposures, especially if liquidity dried up, what that could mean to the institution in terms of losses. So that's where we would focus on more from the safety and soundness and risk management, not so much as how they were providing or liquidity to the marketplace.
So you didn't assess the relationship with the interdealer brokers, or did you look at the relationship with the clearinghouses? I guess J.P. Morgan was a member, clearing member of the CME. Mm-hmm. They probably already were a clearing member of ICE Trust, and maybe some of the other also securities clearinghouses. Was that also part of the purview there?
As far as looking at how they managed that counterparty credit risk and how well they understood what that risk was, yes, but not really focused on their volume of activity.
Right, so you're not concerned whether the prices are transparent or whether even the transactions are suitable for their client. It's just so long, it's a risk management back to the firm that's the key. That's the metric through which you have to assess their conduct.
Less concerned about the price transparency, we did spend a lot of time around suitability and how well the bank knew their customers. We spent a significant amount of time on that. And that was something that the bank spent a lot of time on as well. If you recall, probably in 2006, the bank ran into some issues with the transaction in Greece, which I think they even went as far as apologizes, people from the firm apologize in front of the Greek parliament for a transaction. But it was one of those things where the firm realized we really need to raise, you know, customer suitability.
That involved a hedge fund and...
Right. They sold a product to a hedge fund, and the hedge fund marketed it to Greece. So, you know, I think they felt like... That was a thing where it was they took reputation risk very seriously there, and they made some pretty dramatic changes to make sure they identified, you know, when they had these transactions, they had what they would refer to as high risk transactions from a reputational risk perspective, mm-hmm. and those things were vetted up through a committee, and there was even a person who could give the final yay or nay on it.
So that was still, though, almost perceived as a risk to the firm.
Absolutely.
As opposed to having a supervisory authority to protect the banking market from unsuitable transactions.
Correct. We were focused on risk to the firm and how they manage it.
As it would come in through reputational risk.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah, but it was something we did spend a significant amount of time on.
Yeah, the transaction is coming back to me now. So it was, although I have notes on it because the Greek pension funds kept calling me up. They're pretty upset about it.
Right.
Now that I think about it, because they really thought they got bamboozled, and they did. Go ahead. I'm having to think as we go because there's certain things I didn't anticipate would come up. Okay. So
quick. Were there other one of the most important things you said here, in your opinion, of the risk management MIS reporting at JPMC, did you or your team, or were you aware of RAD having the opportunity or getting sucked into being involved in any of the analysis at Bayer or Lehman, Morgan Stanley, as they applied to be a BHC and went through an acquisition? Was there any opportunities for benchmarking where you could see risk management and some of these activities in the other firms?
Not that I was involved in.
Not that you were involved in.
No.
That's a shame.
With one caveat there. After there was a senior supervisors group, spent a lot of time conducting interviews with the global dealers around the world on how they manage risk and identify counterparty credit risk and exposures. So I was involved in that to some extent, sitting in on some of the interviews that were conducted at some of our firms and their ability to aggregate those exposures.
Did you get a sense that one firm got it and another firm didn't?
Absolutely. And I think also those firms were asked to do a self-assessment on their
yes.
ability. And it was clear to me, I think this is, it was clear to me from looking through those self-assessments that the firms that were what I felt were the best at managing counterparty credit risk were the hardest in terms of self-assessment on where they needed to improve. And the firms that I felt, and again, this is, you know, an opinion, but the firms I felt that could improve seemed to be somewhat glowing of their self-assessment of their ability to manage credit or counterparty credit risk.
They thought they were better than they were.
That's the way it's what read to me when I compared that. I think also some firms I was involved in some interviews with firms in out of Canada, and it was clear to me that they also had the view that, well, we know we're not sophisticated, so we're going to stick to what we know. So,
some of the firms that maybe weren't up to snuff, as the main mail question, in that process with the senior supervisors, and we've talked with others about that group, were there ones that stuck out as, oh, there's an issue here?
Not off the top of my head, anything that stuck out. It was more just kind of, you know, some knowledge of maybe some one-off exams I had spent at those firms in combination with looking at their self-assessments.
One last set of questions I wanted to ask you about was having to do with the repurchase agreement market. J.P. Morgan is a clearing bank in that market, one of the two major ones.
Right. The tri-party repo you're speaking of? Yeah.
And they're also, on a bilateral basis, they're a major dealer in repo, and then, of course, they're members of FICC, and so which plays a role as primary dealer in the Treasury securities market. So all that seems to be part and parcel of the same type of activity. They may perhaps do it at two different desks, but I was wondering how you begin to look at that as a safety and soundness supervision. Is that tri-party clearing bank within the bank charter?
That activity was within the bank charter, that's correct. Right, the tri-party repo activity, yes. Yeah. So we did spend time looking at that and how they manage that risk. You know, it was one of those things because the market was so liquid and a lot of, you know, very short dated instruments, it wasn't you're not thinking about the entire market shutting down on you and what that could mean. So it's, you know, that's again kind of like how you looked at contingency funding. You're looking at that as what could happen to the firm, not everybody melting down. Mm-hmm. So you were thinking about that tri-party repo. What if there was one firm out there, not everybody? So, yeah, clearly I think when that kind of changed the view of the risk within that business, when you think about all of the market shutting down as it did.
What about the intraday lending that was going on that wasn't secured in the same way? I mean, there's the, you know, as a tri-party agent, the overnight lending is really between two third parties.
Right.
You're just an agent that handles the collateral and
that's right.
Makes the transit. But on an intraday basis, your JPM is putting up the cash. Now, you've got some claim to their assets, so they're still in custody, but that's still a very large, concentrated. What was the thinking there on the safety and soundness of that?
That was more focused on what those individual exposures were, instead of really looking at the aggregate potential. It was more focused on maybe similar to what we do from, just to make an example, when we look at a credit portfolio, you're assessing the individual risk in those credits. You're not thinking about the entire portfolio melting down. But yeah, so it's really managing that individual counterparty credit risk was more in focus.
And so, but there was no fear that was putting untoward concentration of risk in the financial system into one or two banks to provide that intraday funding for pretty much the whole financial
system. I think there was always that concern. But I don't know if people had really thought about, had spent enough time thinking about how that could change. But yeah, there was that concern of you do have this activity in two firms. I know there's been I haven't been involved with it, but I know there was a working group on that made some recommendations to change that whole process to reduce that intraday risk.
But Europe's gone to a publicly owned utility to do that.
Right, right.
And then you don't have the intraday funding problem.
Right.
The same.
Right.
It's
interesting you bring this up because I've thought about that same issue of concentrating that exposure if we start to move to CCPs. You know, because credit risk doesn't go away, it just is transferred to somebody else.
But it goes away insofar you have better multilateral netting.
Well, there you're right, there is that.
And you goes away in the sense that you've got one entity that's supposedly managing the collateral better than anybody else.
difficult.
If you compare it to the bilateral OTC derivatives clearing activity that goes on.
If that is going on, if they have the right risk management. But yeah, I think that's something to consider, that if it goes there, there's, you need to make sure those CCPs have that risk management in place too.
Yeah, but it definitely concentrates it. But
right.
It may concentrate it in a way that's still more stable than kind of quasi-dispersion or something. But, I mean, how do you guys assess the risk? I mean, if I'm regulating J.P. Morgan and they're at one time 50%, maybe now 25% of the tri-party repo market, how much capital you hold against ACT? I mean, since you're an agent, except for the intraday credit advance, does that mean there's no capital charge because I'm just an agent here? It's a fee business as a custodian and third-party clearing entity?
Or that I don't know the answer to. I don't know.
Did you guys ever assess whether they were doing an excellent or adequate job of managing that collateral?
Not specifically in my area. I know.
Would
that
you be surprised if we'd heard from numerous people that they were seriously doubting whether that was being handled properly, and that was one of the reasons they were in repo markets?
Oh, are you saying you had heard that?
From numerous people in the market.
That would surprise me a little bit. That would surprise me.
And that was that people that were saying that's why J.P. Morgan's 25% instead of 50% now part of it. Because they really were disappointed in their efficient management of that agent activity.
Wow.
And they were also upset how they saw that, you know, one reason that Lehman and Bear died was that they got cut off by J.P. Morgan. They had J.P. Morgan as a clearing bank instead of Bonnie.
Right.
J.P. Morgan cut them off. And bought them for $1 a share. Some people looked at that askance too. Is that, is that just good business practice, or how's that from
that
banking regulator's point of view?
That I don't know anything about to comment on. I will say that was an activity that I believe was conducted in the Treasury and Securities Services. Mm-hmm. Line of business. Within J.P. Morgan, they had the retail bank, the commercial bank, the investment bank, which is primarily where I looked at, the treasury function, and then there was the Treasury and Security Services, and that was covered by the folks, our asset management team. So I did not spend, things I would know about would be what they had looked at. Or whether we spend any time talking to folks in Treasury about it. But that was kind of a different division within the bank that I didn't spend time on.
Okay.
So that
would that be more the guys at OCC? Would that be more the trading risk people or the credit risk people?
It's actually more in the asset the credit risk people have become more involved, but it's been primarily asset management people. So
I just remember two classes of OCC examiners there. I don't remember the asset management class. Is that part of the trading?
No, that's separate.
It's a subcategory of the credit risk people?
No, it's its own separate line. At J.P. Morgan, we had the EIC, and then we would have team leaders, and I was the capital markets team leader.
Mm-hmm.
There was a commercial credit team leader, a retail credit team leader, IT team leader, information technology, and a person who covered operational risk, and then a person who was in charge of asset management. So that activity, and then
on top of your 6 to 8 guys and the 20 guys at credit risk, you've got a bunch of other guys there.
And there's a compliance risk head too. So there was total on our team of approximately across all of those risk areas, approximately 60 to 65 people.
Wow. Okay.
Now, on that tri-party working group, the person from the OCC that was active in that was in our asset management group.
That makes sense.
I think that is my understanding. That's something that our credit risk people have started to spend more time on.
Because it just strikes me as, you know, if you can, because I've sat on J.P. Morgan's repo desk, you know, a bit, and from another job, and you know, you can lay on a lot of derivative-like exposure through repos by, you know, you're lending out term for 4 weeks and you're short it for 3 weeks, and so you basically got a forward curve of 1 week starting 3 weeks out, and then you can, you know, do a lot of long-term capital kind of spread plays because you're a primary dealer, so you can easily short all the on-the-runs, and you've got some inventory of off-the-runs that you're financing by repoing them out. So you've got a lot of things there that you can run through the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, and then all you have is a net position on your balance sheet with the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation. Because all you have is what you put up there as collateral, right? And that's what's on your balance sheet, but you've got embedded in that, because that's all just netted down on a portfolio basis, you've got all kinds of price exposures embedded in those, what are called your master trading agreement through the repo, right? And there's price risk in there. A lot of price risk. And now you might think the yield curve isn't very interesting 3 or 4 weeks out, but a couple of $1 billion on it makes, you know, certainly cover our salaries. So, you know, there's, I didn't know also, too, then that's just some part of that management information system is on top of that, too, and say that, okay, no, look, but we're margined up at the FIC, and that's a AAA clearinghouse, so that's good. And our models show that, yeah, we've got our interest rate book between what's on our balance sheet, what's, you know, in those positions that are cleared through the FIC. We've all got a wrap on that, and we're, you know, delta neutral, or we've delta something that we want, and we know it's what we want, and we think it won't change more than X. I mean, so you're confident all that is just something that's in that system and is being calculated accurately, and they've got adequate capital against it.
I would not know the answer to that. As that type of MIS, I would not have seen. That would have been within the asset management people would have been looking at that.
Okay.
We're now at 4 o'clock.
Okay. Well, this is good. JP Morgan's a big bank. It's sort of, you can ask them questions about that, because it's the whole gamut of the financial system.